time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for the post-apocalyptic polar vortex on Saturday, February 2nd, 2019. I mean, even our dogs had to run outside, do their business, and limp back in because their paws were so cold. But that is in the past now, and it's time for a brand new episode of The Outspoken Cyclist. I do have one quick housekeeping item to go over first. WJCU's Radiothon 2019 is about to wind it up. Yep, it's that time of year again, and beginning next Friday, February 8th, we will be taking your pledges online at wjcu.org or by phone at 216-397-4438. There are some lovely parting gifts, Don Pardo, and for those who get that, I guess we're getting old, and WJCU is celebrating a big anniversary this year. Indeed, the radio station is turning 50. Please mark your calendar to pledge your support beginning next Friday. Remember that all the money raised goes directly to the station and its operating costs, and we thank you in advance. Our show this evening begins with a delightful conversation. Deb Banks, a.k.a. the Rivetress, is in fact the proprietor of Rivet Cycle Works, manufacturing a line of classically beautiful and functional leather saddles. But wait, there's way more to Deb than saddles. With a PhD in education, Deb spent 30 years in academia before deciding to head out of Boulder and back to California where she grew up. Today, she not only wears the Rivet hat, but also has a key role in RUSA, Randonneurs USA, as well as putting together a Brevet series in Northern California. Deb is still recovering from a major crash in 2014, and yet, she's hoping to do Paris-Brest-Paris this year. After a break, we'll talk with Michael Roth from AEG, the world's leading sports and live entertainment company. AEG is the producer of the Amgen Tour of California, among a whole lot of other things. And this week, the 2019 Amgen routes were introduced, touting the longest and most challenging men's and women's routes in the race's 14-year history. We'll ask Michael about the routes and who might be showing up to the race. We'll also ask him about the charitable things that have come out of the partnership between Amgen and AEG, including a very respectable donation to the Red Cross after the California fires last fall. So let's head on out to the West Coast for a conversation with the Rivetress, Deb Banks. Hi, Deb. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show. You are cracking me up and we're not even on air yet.
Thank you, Diane. I'm totally thrilled to be here.
Oh, that's great. So I have a hello for you from our mutual friend, Paul Baccio. I saw him this morning.
All right.
He's starting his brevets next week. He's heading down to Florida.
Oh, well, lucky him. I'm actually riding a 200K this weekend. We call it the speed run, and it's basically Healdsburg to Napa and back.
Mm.
And it's usually a quick ride, though I don't think mine will be very fast.
Well, we'll talk about that. We'll talk about that.
Okay. So we'll get there.
You and I did speak briefly at Peter Weigel's French Fender Days last fall, and I did promise to catch up with you, and I'm really excited to be able to talk with you today, too. So can we begin with your background? I know you wear a whole bunch of hats, and you even have a new hat recently. So
yeah, my background in terms of what I used to do for work.
No, start with where you grew up, where you came from.
Oh, you'll love this. I'm from Shaker Heights, Ohio.
No, are you kidding me?
Born in Shaker Heights.
That is so funny.
Yeah, I'm a Cleveland girl.
2 miles down the road. Did you grow up here?
Well, my parents moved to Los Angeles in 1969. So I did junior high and high school in L.A.
Uh-huh.
And then did what a lot of people do is I went to college as far away from my parents as I could get, but still stay in state.
So you came to the East Coast.
No. I went up to Humboldt State and then migrated over to Boulder, Colorado, where I lived for the next 30 years and got a couple of degrees behind my name. Not in bicycling at all, though I did ride a bike during all that time.
So what are your degrees in then?
I have a PhD in education and education leadership and innovation. I used to have a consulting practice that helped our inner city kids and our hardest to staff schools get the kind of teachers they needed and to support their parents in sort of working through the system and learning how the system works. A lot of upper income families know how to do that, but a lot of lower income families are at a loss how to help get the best services for their kids when they're needed. And so I worked with a number of very excellent educators out of Washington, D.C., actually, and did this work nationwide. It was great.
Sounds like a really cool thing to do. And today, So you're not in it anymore. They could probably use your resources today.
Yeah, you know, I left education partially, and I agree, yes. But what I found, I needed to take a break. I was somewhat burnt out, and I felt like there was a lot of money and a lot of energy into the business of education. And I feel, and I still do, that we know what we need to do, but we're not changing the needle very much. And a lot of that is because there isn't the political will. So it's hard to stay in the business to collect a great paycheck. That's great. But I know this sounds a little altruistic, but I needed to take a break. And I felt bad that we weren't making the changes that we knew we should be making and could be making. And so I stopped to take a break and then had a watershed change in my life and moved away from education.
Clearly. So then you did take that break from the Republic of Boulder, as we used to call it. You went to the West Coast.
I did. I had a yearning to come back to California and did so and resettled up in Northern California. Got involved in the bicycle world, the saddle business world, at a fluke, actually. I was dating a man who owned a bicycle company, and he died of a heart attack on a bike ride. And I jumped in to keep his company afloat and then got a very steep learning curve on the bicycle business and on saddles, et cetera, and then decided to start my own business as a result of that. So talk about a sharp turn.
Yeah, really.
Change.
Are we talking about the gentleman who started Sella Anatomica?
We are. Yeah. Tom Milton. And
So sad.
And his family still runs
Sella
Anatomica. So we are friendly competitors these days.
Right. That's right. He has two sisters. That's right. So
yes.
I read an article, I don't know how long ago it was written, in the Sacramento Bee that said you ride 12,000 plus miles a year. At least you did. Now I know that something has sort of short-circuited that. How did you find so much time to ride and run your business?
Well, that's the beautiful thing about being in the bicycle world. R&D was riding my bike and talking to people and talking to them about their saddles or their butt issues, if you will. And so it was easy. It's also a very flexible business. So in the middle of the day, if it's a lovely day, I can go out for a ride and then come back and work in the evening. I have distributors in Japan and in Australia. So their daytime is my nighttime. So, you can be flexible and chunk your time both, for the fun part and the more business part as you need.
Right. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Deb Banks. She is the Rivet Tress, and we'll talk about the website and how to find out more about her saddles as we move through this conversation. I want to know a little bit about your work in randonneuring, too. I think that randonneuring has become, a reprisal maybe here in the States. I know it never went away in some ways, but it seems to be growing right now.
It always ebbs and flows around Paris years, of which this year is a PVP year. So you'll see a swelling in the ranks. It has definitely had a resurgence, I would say, partially because of Jan Heine and Bicycle Quarterly and his love of French constructeurs, Peter, of course, Mr. Weigel, who gave me the name Rivetress, by the way. And then a number of frame builders who have fallen suit and have fallen in love with that style of cycling and bicycles. RUSA, Randonneurs USA, of which I happen to be the vice president of these days, has had approximately 3,500 members. And that's been pretty steady over the course of, I don't know, a decade, two decades. So it seems like it's growing, but it actually kind of stays, you know, it oscillates at a pretty even key, if you will, but always swells for PBP years and then dissipates a little bit afterwards. So you either get the bug or you don't, or you get it to ride PBP and that becomes a bucket list, you know, activity, you do it and then you're done. But those of us that have been around for a while, and I had dinner last night with someone who's been in randonneuring for over 30 years, you know, I'm a newbie at it. I'm only at it 11,
right,
comparatively to some people. So,
right,
you know.
Yeah, like Paul Baccio, who is doing his 9th this year.
Yeah.
And hoping to do 10. That was his goal, is to do 10.
I think that's incredible.
Yeah, it is incredible. I think he holds some sort of American record, which is, or shares it, which is really cool. I mean, if you saw him and you watched him ride, you'd go, how the heck does he do this? He's just so casual about it, but clearly he gets in the saddle and he just rides, right?
Yeah, you know, there's something too that once you get into pretty good shape, if you can deal with the sleep deprivation and the stomach issues, then your legs just kind of keep ticking over and you manage all the other parts of the sport, the actual being in shape. And, you know, once you get your body attuned to your bike and doing long distances, it's really not so much the pedaling. It's all the other factors that after, you know, 3 days of riding straight through in rain or wind or whatever it is that start to be the real challenge of the sport.
Do you think that shows like this and PBP and just the whole idea that people are looking at more ultra kinds of things, not just in biking, but in running and all kinds of other sports, triathlon, that randonneuring might actually get bigger? I mean, it seems to me such a cool sport.
It is a very cool sport. I think it could be. What I'm finding is that what's really growing in the bicycle world right now is gravel,
right,
riding, gravel grinding, et cetera. And we in RUSA are working on having more rides. We call them gateway rides, you know, drugs, if you will, that will give you a taste and then get you hooked and hopefully get you to stick around and stay into randonneuring, that once you get involved in it, that you like it enough that you want to continue. And so we're working on including more gravel rides that helps cross over people that really love to do that kind of stuff and maybe get them more involved in the endurance side of, you know, the long, long endurance side of riding. So that's one way to do it for sure. I do think that one of the things about endurance riding or running, et cetera, is that it's not for young people. They typically have higher heart rates and they like the quicker, zippier type of exercise, and then they're done, 2 hours, whatever, they're finished, where we, you know, will spend all day riding our bike and enjoy that. So A, you have to have time for that. And younger people typically are in the middle of their careers, maybe raising a family. It's hard to get the time to do this sport, as certainly at the longer levels. I'm not saying higher levels because I'm not a fast randonneur or randonneuse, by the way, but
correct,
I have the time to do it. And, you know, many other people who have other things going on in their lives can't carve out that time. And that's a limiting factor for sure.
Eventually they get older.
That's right. And so you'll
and their
find
kids
that
leave home and they, you know, retire or whatever it is. But it is an interesting point,
right,
one that I hadn't thought of. So we're going to put a different hat on your head and we're going to talk about Rivet Cycle Works.
Right.
How did you get into making, Sala Anatomica? That's how you got interested, I guess.
Well, that's it. And so when I, picking that story thread back up, when after Tom passed away, I went to Europe for Eurobike and met his distributors, et cetera. And a few of them took me under their wing. And we just had a whirlwind, you know, sort of accelerated class in the bicycle industry. We went to Taiwan together and I met with and worked with a number of different folks in the industry and decided to work on a saddle. And so what I did was I talked to a lot of people here, sort of de-engineering my first round of saddles, speaking to a lot of people and then taking the best qualities of all of the saddles that were out there. I mean, I owned Brooks saddles. I owned Gilles Bertu saddles. I owned, of course, Sella Anatomica saddles. And I would take the best from the best and try to fix the problems that all of these other saddles seem to have, and that's all anecdotal. You know, people will tell you what they like or don't like, and every saddle is different, and every person who rides a saddle is different, and of course, we all have opinions. So it's somewhat anecdotal, but I tried to collect all that data and come up with designs that would take the best from the best and fix the problems. And that's how I kind of went after it.
Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to find out why Rivet CycleWorks saddles are a little bit different. You're listening to The okay. Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
So we are back, and if you are just joining me, I am speaking with Deb Banks. She wears a bunch of hats. One is as RUSA, the Randonneur USA Vice President, I guess. Is that the new hat?
Well, I've had it for a couple of years, but okay. Okay. I'm also the Regional Brevet Administrator for the Davis-Sacramento Northern California region, which is great.
Why not? But we were talking about saddles. And since saddles are such a huge, I don't know, they're a stumbling block for people. It took me years to find a saddle that I like. My husband finally talked me into, not a Rivet, unfortunately, although you have one that looks similar, and I want to know what some of the differences are. But I finally ended up on a Brooks that I could ride and not fall off of and not hate. What do you think people need to know about saddles, and why are Rivet saddles, what have you incorporated that makes them different?
Well, a couple of things. One is I'm a big believer in leather saddles, and I know that's hard sometimes in inclement climes where right now it's snowing or raining heavily. But the thing about a leather saddle is once it breaks in, it fits you like your favorite shoes. And that's a lovely thing, especially when you're riding your bike around the world or around, you know, long distances. And I figured if we get it comfortable for those kinds of distances, then it should work when you're going to the grocery store around the block or meeting friends for beers. What we did was try to come up with a leather saddle that was stiff, firm, but forgiving. And, you know, you can manage the stiffness of saddles using a variety of different techniques. And I wanted them not to be super soft because I don't think that that's as good for your anatomy over the long haul. Your pelvis will start to tilt, sort of like sitting in a soft leather couch that after a while you can't get out of and your back starts to hurt. I wanted to mitigate that, but I didn't want it to be so brick hard that the old Brooks adage is, I didn't break the saddle in, the saddle broke me in. So, you know, trying to find what's that sweet spot, we worked on that. And I wanted to make sure that the saddle, when it did start to break in, that the fenders, which are the sides of the saddles, didn't flare. Meaning, as you sit down, the edges splay outward.
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Right. And it goes into your inner thigh, which is not comfortable at all and actually is detrimental to your bike shorts. And so you want to mitigate all of those things. So I tried to come up with the saddle that managed all of that. And then the last thing was for it not to be so heavy. I really think that while a lot of randonneurs and people who are riding steel bikes, et cetera, they're not huge weight weenies, so to speak, like our carbon racer friends. But, you know, it does matter. And so I wanted it to be as light as it could, do all those other things. Finally, I wanted it to look great. And I think I've hit the mark on that. People regularly comment on how good looking the saddles are. Any component on your bike should be as good looking as every other component, especially on those gorgeous customized bikes that you've, you know, purchased. You spent a lot of money on those. Why would you put something that's also not have that kind of care attached to it?
Those are a lot of components that yeah. are going into them. So what are some of the things you found that didn't work?
The first iteration of my titanium saddles were both called the Pearl and the Diablo. And just quickly, I've got actually six different models, and they're based on different widths. So when people are trying to find a saddle, I talk to them at length about what riding they do, what's their bike setup, and what's their sit bone width, so that they're not sitting on the frame of the saddle. Original leather saddles were all metal frames, and Jill's Vertu saddles and my saddles have a composite rear nose and rear frame that lightens things up and also absorbs some shock. So that's a little bit more of a modernizing of the traditional leather saddle. So with that said, my first round of saddles had all metal fixtures, and the nose would break. So as you put pressure sitting down on a saddle, typically the nose and the rear frame will pull up. That's where the release of the tension. And the nose of the saddle has a 90-degree angle in it, and titanium doesn't like 90-degree angles, and so they would break. And as a randonneur and as somebody in the business, the last thing I wanted was that kind of a showstopper where your saddle breaks in the middle of the night when you're on your qualifying 600K.
Yeah, no kidding.
Not good. So I spent a lot of time working on that nose after I had a number of those break, and have now fixed that nose issue. And I haven't had any breakage in saddles now for, a good couple of years. So people that have my earlier iterations of saddles, I will, trade them out or help them with a new saddle in whatever way I can. Even though they're out of warranty, we figure something out, because that was a flaw in the design. That's been the biggest fix. And it's been a huge, fantastic, piece for the company.
So I have a question about something you said a little bit earlier about the flaring out of the of the outer edges of the saddle, because I know that the biggest issue, and I'm just going to pick your brain here. The biggest issue I have riding, and if I have it, I know other people have it, is this discomfort on the really upper inner thigh, where I don't think I need more padding in the shorts. I think, in fact, I need a better transition in either the saddle and or the shorts. And so I'm wondering if the flare is what might be causing this discomfort. And it's specifically on one side, although I don't think I reach any farther with one leg than the other.
Well, we're all asymmetrical. That has been hammered into me just even recently in my yoga weekend.
I was just going to say, you must be doing some yoga, because I tell my students that every single class. You are asymmetrical.
Yes, Francisco was hammering me on that this weekend. But the flare of the saddle, it's both the flare of the fenders as you sit down on it that can be impeding the as you pedal at the rear, at the bottom of your stroke, and on the, the up, that back, as you pull your leg up and over the top. You are now pressing up against the back of the saddle. And if the saddle doesn't fit you right, that's going to impede your circle, right? You want to pedal circles, not squares.
Right.
And so if you don't have a saddle that allows you to do that well, it's not about your shorts. It's not about your legs. It's about the shape of the saddle in that instance. I think that's what you're talking about.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Coming down to the fact that, I've tried every pair of shorts there is, and I think my pedal stroke is good and my saddle height is right, and so what the hell, right?
Well, it seems to me that very likely it's just possible the shape of the saddle.
And
if you were on my website and you looked at all of the saddles, which are all lined up next to each other, you'll see that they are slightly different in the shape from the rear of the saddle to the front nose. Some of it is much sharper, so that when you're down in the drops, you have much more of that follow through in your pedal stroke. Some of them are a little bit more obtuse versus acute, I guess, in that angle or that curve, so that as you're sitting more upright, that, your pelvis tilt and the way your leg pedals, even though you're making circles, it's slightly different depending on how you're situated on your bike, whether you're sitting upright, out on the hoods, down in the drops. Your pelvis and your body is changing. It's canting at different angles. And therefore, your legs, while they're making circles, they're also changing because your hip structure is changing.
Oh, such good explanation.
Oh, I'm glad that was helpful.
Yeah. You know, people will rewind and re-listen. Let me take another moment to remind you we're speaking with Deb Brooks. We're talking about her rivet saddles. We will give you the website toward the end of our conversation. I was going to ask you two other questions. What happens if a saddle that gets ordered just doesn't work?
I mean, you return it.
Really?
Really easy. I have two things that really, I think, sets my company apart. I have a 365-day return policy. Buy it and ride it for almost a year and return it, and it's fine. No questions asked. I mean, I'll want to know what didn't work, et cetera.
Sure.
Again, always data gathering and seeing if there's something else that you may want to try. But if you know that it's not the right saddle for you, then that's great. And I wish you the best of luck in your search, because I think, you know, finding a great saddle, it may not be mine. It may not be a rivet, but I really want you to be happy on your bike. So if it's not mine, okay. If it is, awesome. We have a try before you buy program where you can try the saddle out. It's like a Netflix for saddles, right? You can try the saddle out for 2-3 months. And if you like it, we settle up. And if you don't like it, we can trade it out. Worst case scenario is nothing works. You're out $30 and some shipping. But you've at least tried a few things and you have more data for you to go on as you continue your search. I, as a cyclist, you know, before I got into the business, I thought, how awful that I had a box full of saddles sitting in my garage, unused, but pretty much brand new, that didn't work. And I just really feel strongly that that's not the way to go. It's not great for the planet. It's not great for customers. And so it may not be a great business model for me, but I feel really strongly about that value. So I'd prefer that to happen.
I totally agree with you. When I had my bike shop, that was our policy. If that stem and or that saddle didn't work for you, we kept trying until we found something that did. It didn't make sense that just because the manufacturer threw that $2 saddle on that bike that you were stuck with it, right?
Right.
The second part of the question was, do you have any new projects you're working on in saddles right now that you can talk about? And you can say no.
I'm flirting with an idea, but I really am not sure about it.
Okay.
Building saddles is a very expensive piece of work. You build the idea and then you purchase all of the manufacturing equipment to make it happen. And it's a huge outlay in cash up front. So I got to make sure that this idea is, because it's a pretty good departure from what I'm doing right now. So we'll see.
Okay.
Stay tuned.
I think that's a really good answer. I like that answer that, well, we don't know, but we'll let you know.
Yeah.
So I want to take another sort of left turn, and I don't know if you want to talk about it, but we have not spoken about the crash in which you and four other riders were involved in 2016. I don't want you
2014,
to... 2014? Why did I think it was 2016? Oh my goodness, so it's going on 5 years this year. And you are still actually suffering some real issues with what happened. Drunk driver, four other riders. Were you the one who was hurt the worst?
I was hurt the worst, though we didn't know it at the time. I was the first one hit, and the man that plowed through us hit all five of us. I was thrown into a ditch unconscious. Another woman was up onto the roof and into the windshield of the car and then drug and underneath the car. The car came to a stop and she was flight for life to Santa Rosa. Turns out, amazingly, knock on wood and, you know, all prayers to whoever you pray to. She was okay. She had some neck issues short term. It could have been absolutely catastrophic for her, and it wasn't, which is amazing. Another person broke his collarbone and his ankle, and he just had another shoulder surgery. So 4 years later, Larry is still dealing with some of his stuff, and everybody else is okay. I ended up having overall 7 surgeries over the course of 2 years, 2015 and 2016. I was basically in either a wheelchair on crutches or in a boot cast, not doing a whole lot of moving around, though I did get some crazy adventuring in. I didn't realize that my leg was still broken at the time when it was. That's a longer story. We don't have time for that in the podcast. However, after 2 years, all of that, so I was finally done. My leg was deemed healed, which was fantastic. And so the last 2 years, I've been trying to get in shape and get stronger and work on my, you know, strength and agility and all that stuff. So just yesterday, 2 days ago, I went to the doctor for the first time in a couple of years to kind of get an update and it was less than stellar, but it is what it is. You know, I have no choice but to move forward and to do the best I can with what I've got.
So being someone who is incredibly interested in and keeps reporting on the issue of being hit by either a distracted or drunk or however other influenced driver, what has happened with the guy who hit you, if anything?
Yeah, he was not a great model citizen to start with. And this was up near a small town in Northern California called Ukiah. And he is a Native American, a Ukiah, a part of the Ukiah Indian tribe. He and his stepfather, who was also in the car, they were both drunk. 14 counts of felony were leveled against this gentleman. So he's in jail and is serving out an 11-year term, which maybe not be long enough in my mind, but it is what it is. So I really don't ever even think about him anymore. He was 18 at the time, so he was tried as an adult. So his life has changed as well. I know that. Yeah, you know, you just sort of like, well, that's what happened, and you move on with what's, you know, in front of you, which is your own physical health and, you know, what you're doing about it.
Right. I guess my question originally was about the fact that he was prosecuted and he is serving jail time. And you know, you hear very often that that is not the case, or that a jury comes back and says, oh, no, the sun was in his eyes, so he didn't see them. And we actually had a case like that here in Ohio.
Right. The sun was not in this gentleman's eyes. It was a straight line, straight shot, empty road, et cetera. I think that because he had priors and was known, this is a small community, that the prosecution was particularly interested in making sure things stuck in this instance. You know, I don't really know the ins and outs of the politics around Ukiah, but I do know that because there were five of us, you know, for every five DUIs, which is a felony, five intent to harm. So it starts to add up pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You could say that or argue that I was an accident because I was the first one hit, you know, but not the other four people because he didn't put his foot on the brakes and pull over until someone was stuck underneath his car.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Anyway.
Okay. Well, number one, I'm glad you are better. Obviously you're riding.
Yes.
Are you going to PBP this year?
Well, I have to qualify.
Oh, that's true.
Good point. We'll see. I call them campaigns. My campaign starts this weekend with the 200K. I'm planning on riding a 600K in April. And it's a lot because I'm both running rides as the regional brevet administrator for other people so they can get to PPP. But it's unlikely I can ride my own rides. But I'm hopeful. I have done a 1200K since this injury. It was fairly flat. It was not last year, but the year before. And I did a series last year. I snuck one in. So I'm hopeful and I'm confident, but I don't at all think I've got it in the bag because I'm a lot older than I was.
Well, aren't we all? So
yes,
I know you have a huge stable of bikes and you have some really beautiful bikes. Am I mistaken, do you own a lot of mixties?
I do.
Yes.
I have a very large Mixie collection, of which I'm very proud. I love those bicycles. Oh, my gosh.
Are you going to ride a Mixie in PBP if you go?
I'm thinking about it.
Good.
I am definitely thinking about it.
Cool.
It's been done. It's not like something new, but it would be new for me to do.
Yeah. I assume you're going to go back to Peter's French Fender Days next fall.
I expect so. As the hostess who runs lunch, if
That's
you'll
true.
Have me.
That's true. Yeah. Well, I'm sure he's going to say either you come or we're not eating. There it could be that. Well, I hope to see you there. So it's time for me to ask my three questions, and then I'll let you get back to making saddles. What's your favorite food?
Arugula.
Seriously? That's pretty cool. I don't think anybody's ever said that. You've got to be the only one. All right. That was easy. What music do you like to listen to?
It's a mix between this. This is really weird. Basque folk music and Joni Mitchell. I mean, when I'm listening, riding my bike, that's what I've got on my headphones.
Basque. Okay, I'll think about that. And do you have any pets?
Well, I don't. My sweetie does. So I have inherited two crazy dogs, Omar the Terrible, a Jack Russell Terrier, and Vicious Starlicious, Star for short, who is a terrier mix, both 15 and absolutely joys. they helped me get through my injuries for sure.
Well, for sure is right. Really cool.
Yeah, they're awesome.
Well, Deb, this has been delightful. Thank you so much. And I would like you to tell our listeners how they can learn more about Rivet Saddles, Miss Rivetress.
Yeah, absolutely. The website is going under a major overhaul right now, but it's still up and running. It's Rivet Cycle Works, all one word. So RivetCycleWorks.com. You can find us there.
All right, Deb Banks, thank you so much for talking with me. Have a great riding year, and I hope to see you at Peter Weigel's French Fender Days in the fall.
Yeah, absolutely, Diane. What a pleasure. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
You take care.
You too. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Deb Banks joined me from her office in Sacramento, California. If you're interested in finding out more about her saddles and some of the other unique items she offers, since no part of the cowl goes to waste, you can log on to RivetCycleWorks.com. Before we take our break, I want to give a shout-out to longtime bicycle fanatic and self-proclaimed aficionado Jim Langley for reaching one amazing milestone. When we spoke with Jim way back in 2013, he had just completed 73,000 miles over a 20-year period, not missing one day of riding. Fast forward to this week, where Jim just posted 9,164 daily consecutive riding days, equaling 25 years. He told me he wasn't always sure he was going to make it, getting older and all, but clearly that is not the case. So if you have a moment and you want to congratulate him, you can find him at jim@jimlangley.net. So let's take our break, and when we come back, we're going to learn all about this year's Amgen Tour of California with Michael Roth from AEG. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Did you know that the Amgen Tour of California is the only UCI World Tour race in the U.S.? It is. This year in May, the men will race seven stages, covering 773 miles with 68,374 feet of elevation gain. There'll be 25 King of the Mountains and 14 sprints. Women will cover 177.8 miles with 20,803 feet of elevation gain over three stages with eight Queen of the Mountains. This event has become a bright, shining star among American cycling. Here is AEG's Michael Roth to tell us more. Hello, Michael. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, AEG supports so many programs in sports and entertainment. I'd like to know a little more about the company and then the connection to the Amgen Tour of California, which is coming up in May.
Thanks for asking. AEG is the largest and premier sports entertainment presenters in the world. We have a couple of core businesses. One is we build and own and operate for others, some of the great, most iconic sports entertainment venues in the world, from the Staples Center in Los Angeles to the O2 in London. And beyond that, we are in Berlin, and we have about 15 venues in Australia and in Shanghai and Beijing, across America in other great cities like Miami and San Antonio and Dallas and Minnesota and Louisville, and we have arenas. We have several dozen clubs and mid-sized theaters for more for entertainment, and we are all over the map there. We also book concert tours. We're the second largest promoter in the world, and tours we have out are now or in the last year are Taylor Swift and Paul McCartney and the Rolling Stones, and along those lines, Justin Bieber, and then we also own and operate sports teams and events. We own the Los Angeles Kings and the Los Angeles Galaxy, and in 2006 decided to launch the Amgen Tour of California, which has become the largest and most prestigious cycling race in America. And dare I say that we are one of the top two or three cycling events in the world every year.
So this begs the question, this is a huge organization. Cycling is such a tiny little sport, at least in the United States. What was it that was so compelling about cycling that you would put this amazing event on? And we've been following it. We report every year on when it will be and what the stages are. I decided to reach out this year because it just sounds so exciting, and I've never really talked to somebody about it on the show.
Well, our owner, our chairman, Phil Anschutz, had a couple reasons to come to us and challenge us to launch a cycling race. One is, you know, when you look back 15 years ago, cycling was at least as popular, maybe even a little more popular because of the Tour de France with Lance Armstrong was getting a lot of ratings and was getting a lot of eyes on it. And there was not a comparable event in the United States. And the thought was, why isn't there a comparable event? Because not only is it an exciting event to watch, when you couple it with the great landscapes and the backgrounds that the cyclists go by, it also is really as popular a sport, a recreational sport in America as any, and which means that, you know, there are millions and millions of people who own bikes and get on bikes and cycle around. So there are people who have entry into the sport. There are people who understand you pedal, you move, but it's also a phenomenal way of maintaining a healthy lifestyle and staying in shape. And so that's something that we believe is important to promote. All of those that came together made a lot of sense. And the fact that there wasn't a lot of competition in the U.S., if we thought that if we launched it the right way, we could really have an impact on the sport. And from a sponsorship and television perspective, we could maybe capture the market at the low end and grow with it and capitalize on that.
Has that happened?
Well, our race has become bigger every single year.
True.
Since 2006. We have more interest from sponsors every year. We have more fans. We have better and more prestigious riders coming in every single year. And in fact, you know, we were able to, a decade ago, launch a women's race alongside of it. And this will be the third year that we have the women's and the men's both on the world tour in our race. So the race has certainly grown in prestige and in respect and around the world. And, you know, our TV ratings go up a little bit. I think there's still a lot of room to grow there, but we do see the trend where it's ticking up, and we're committed to this sport. We have not yet turned a profit on it, but thankfully we have the ability because of the good it does for the sport and the message we can send to people about cycling and what an important part of a healthy lifestyle it is. We can continue to go with it, and our title sponsor since day one, Amgen, is incredibly supportive of it. And around the race, they have launched two foundations that I think have raised a lot of money for important causes like Breakaway from Cancer, which is one of their charities that they started, and also Breakaway from Heart Disease, which helps to promote again healthy lifestyle and what you can do to as preventative ways for heart disease.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Michael Roth. He is with the Amgen Tour, but he is with AEG, which is the organization that actually founded and puts on the race. Can we talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts of the race itself for a second? Because this
sure.
year's... This
nuts, year, bolts, and gears.
And years.
Gears with a G.
Oh, nuts, bolts, and gears. Okay, very cute. That was good. I love it. It's a
first time I ever did that. Use that line. It's okay. It will not be the last. I'm sure of that.
You might want to write it down. You can use
yes.
it again. All right. So there are some really daunting climbs. Now, of course, everybody thinks about Europe. Everybody thinks about L'Alpe d'Huez and Ventoux and all of those climbs. There are some really daunting climbs in the Amgen Tour. Who works out all these routes? Who's actually out there?
We started a strategic partnership with the Omri Sport Organization about 5 or 6 years ago, and they are the organization that owns and puts on the Tour de France. So we had some people who are really experts in the field that were that have been with us the whole time, but using them and a couple of executives we share with ASL from France, they get in a car and they drive around our state, and it's so amazing. I've lived in my entire life in California, but we have people from Georgia and from Paris that know our state and know the roads and the climbs and the hills and the valleys probably better than anybody I know that's been here all their lives, because they've made it a point to really understand the state and the typography of it and how to put together a great race. They know what a great race needs. They know what our race needs. When you only have a 7-day race, you want to be able to include climbs and sprints and scenery and all. Every year they do an unbelievably great job of combining them all. And some years more climbs and sprints, but we always have to have them both because the riders really want that, because it's the last major race before the Tour de France at a good 7 or 8 days always. So it's great training, but they want to be able to train at different types of landscapes and different types of climbs and like that. So we have people that just drive around and figure it out. And we also have cities that are vying to be host cities that would like to host a stage, a start or a finish of the race. And so when they contact us and fill out the forms and we start to have our discussions, they will typically pitch to us what their city has that will lend itself to our race. And, you know, there's cities that have healthy cycling communities. And so we know that people from Mount Baldy in Ontario will come to us and say, you know, we have all these cyclists who every weekend ride their bikes up Mount Baldy, or, you know, ride their bikes up Mount Diablo, or different areas. And they know what the cyclists in their area are challenged by. And often these are areas that will challenge even the best riders in the world.
So do you actually invite teams and then they say yes or no, or do teams vie to come to the tour?
Well, you know what? It's a combination. Early on, before we were the World Tour team, we went out and invited everybody that we thought would have riders that would help to promote the race and sell the race. And if a team had a name that was known to cycling fans, we wanted to have them in. If a team had a great cyclist as their lead rider, we'd want to have them in, because it was all about, in the beginning, promoting the race and growing the race. And the more popular riders and teams you have, the better off you are. So people, you know, who is doing well in the Tour de France? So we went after the big teams. We also, it's very important to us to promote the sport of cycling. And between the professional teams and the teams that are in a little lower level down, they are still able to, you know, no matter who the teams are, in this, put a competitive team out. And so we were inviting the teams with the big budgets and the not so big budgets, some California-based teams that were competing and winning stages in a race. So while we're inviting the best teams in the world and the most popular and the most funded, we're also inviting teams that will, as long as they're competitive, will help to promote riders who need a little extra help, teams that need a little extra help. But these are the riders that are also feeding into the World Tour teams down the road.
Do you know how many riders there will be for men and women this year already, or not?
We typically have 16 teams in the men's and about the same in the women's. We launched the women's event about 10 years ago alongside of this, and it's the first time we did it was a 1-day race, and we've increased that. It's great to show the women riding at the same time as the men, and it shows up because the women are every bit as competitive, and, you know, and some of them are every bit as strong, and it makes for great racing. So we this year have three stages of a women's race along our 7 stages of men's race. We have Olympic champions. We have national champions in the women's alongside the men. And it's a great way to showcase women's cycling, which has become more and more popular in the world. And there's a women's world tour as well.
Right, right. How about the purse? Is it relatively equal for men and women?
Our purse is based on the number of stages.
Okay.
And we offer the same prize money per stage to the men that we do the women. We feel that was an important statement to make. So we've done that for the last couple of years.
Perfect. How about spectators? All right. So one of the big problems I see with cycling, and if you're not watching it on television, off they go, they come by you, they're gone. So what are the opportunities for spectators?
Well, that's the great part of our race also, is because it's all about the race, but it's all about the experience and the lifestyle and the day around the race. So, yes, there are some cities where we start and finish close enough where the riders, if they're on the road for 4 or 5 hours, you would actually have the opportunity to be at the start, jump in your car, go a little different direction, and come by at the end and see them finish as well, stop along the way. But at every finish line, and some of the start lines, we have festivals that go on. And so, you know, we encourage our fans to come out 2-3 hours before the finish, walk through the lifestyle festival, see what healthy cyclists are doing to maintain their fitness. We have booths from both lifestyle companies and hardcore cycling companies. You know, what are the newest gears? What are the newest brakes? What are the newest kits that people wear? What are the newest bike racks? So if you're a cyclist and the helmets and all those things are available in our festival. So it's a way for people to sort of, you know, meet up with other enthusiasts and meet up with the professional companies. And we have music. We have interviews that go on the finish stage. And so it really is a full day for people who want to make it that way. So, and then we have huge TV screens at our finish line and around that area. So you can definitely follow the race. And some of the cities will actually have 4 or 5 circuits around the city at the end. So every 10 minutes they come around for half an hour, and you can start to see the strategy and how, you know, which cyclists are holding back and which ones are going all out. And it does make a really full day.
So I have 2 more questions before I let you go. One is, there is a public ride, a stage that's open to the fans. When is that and what's that all about?
You know what? Different cities have different public rides.
Nice.
And I think that they're still setting them, and okay, I think there will be more than one public ride this year. What I would tell people is to go to the AmgenTourOfCalifornia.com, and you can go stage by stage and see what's offered in each city.
Perfect. My last question is about television. Will the tour be televised completely, or will there just be specific stages televised?
Well, no. What one of the things that we were insistent on is when you grow a race, and it's something that if you're a cycling fan, you need to watch every day, because, as you know, there's a great story that starts the first day and finishes at the last day. We don't know what the story is or will be, but there are great stories every day, but there's also one that weaves itself through, is, you know, who starts out in the lead. Are they overtaken? Did somebody overtake them? So it was a non-starter for us. You know, we had to be on TV every day. So we are on the NBC Sports Network every single day of the race for a minimum of 2 hours every single day. And the 2 hours, you know, starts into the race and will go right through the finish. So every finish of the race and then back up 2 hours is on the NBC Sports Network. And we'll have likely the last day will be jumped over to NBC, the
network,
the
show.
Big NBC.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we have the greatest cycling commentators. That's really what helps grow the sport is the television broadcast, and no money is spared with that.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for talking with me. We've been talking with Michael Roth. He's with AEG. They put on the Amgen Tour of California, and you can go to AmgenTourOfCalifornia.com to find out when the stages are. What are the dates? May?
I'm glad you asked.
Yeah, really?
12th to the 18th in 2019. The 2019 Amgen Tour of California is held May 12th to 18th. For the men, and the women start on May 16th and go through the 18th. So we're going to have both the women and the men racing alongside. We're racing on practically the same routes the last 3 days, and it's really going to be quite spectacular. Come out anywhere along our 773-mile course.
Absolutely. And in our show, we've also got some more details. You can go to the Facebook page and our Facebook page and see more details, and go to Amgen Tour of California. Michael Roth, thank you so much for talking with me today. This has been awesome.
My pleasure.
All right. Take care. Michael Roth joined me from the offices of AEG in California. If you're interested in knowing more about the Amgen Tour of California, log on to AmgenTourOfCalifornia.com, or you can check out their Facebook page and their Twitter feed. I want to thank Michael Roth and Deb Banks for being my guests this week. I hope you enjoyed this week's show. You can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. Send us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without an E, or leave us a message on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. Finally, just a reminder that the Outspoken Cyclist is a listener-supported show. If you find it of value and want to help to support it, please make a donation at OutspokenCyclist.com. So thank you for listening. We will be back next week with a killer conversation with ex-pro cyclist Phil Guymon as we talk about his new book, Draft Animals, and a whole bunch of other stuff. I hope you have a great week. Stay warm, stay safe, and if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.